Welcome to Life, Liberty, Reason. I'm James Elias. Thank you for joining my journey through the history of philosophy. Each week, we'll explore the ideas of men in history who have defined the way we think. The sources for the program can be found in the description below the player on Blog Talk Radio. This week, we will discuss the first founding father of the United States of America. His formulation of the principles of liberty gave voice to the spirit of the Age of Reason, that man's mind should be free. His name was John Locke. If we think of Captain America as being the first Avenger, the superhero that came a generation before the others, we should think of John Locke as the first founding father. His contribution to epistemology, which is what we will start with, however, was somewhat less glorious. In the wake of Newton's achievements, we had two different camps emphasizing different halves of Newton's achievement. One half emphasized the logical deduction and logical structure inherent in Newton's system, that Newton was able to bring all kinds of different scientific equations and observations together into just a few principles, all flawlessly deduced from a set of premises. The other camp emphasized logical induction, the fact that Newton's ideas had come from experimentation and observation of reality. But the fact is that Newton's achievement came from a profound blending of both of these perspectives. The challenge in philosophy, which has been plaguing it ever since Newton's achievement, is how to join these two worlds. And in fact, the challenge of joining the world of logical deduction and observational induction is, in a sense, the problem that even the Greeks had faced since the beginning. How do we join the world of the mind to the world that we see with our senses? And this problem continues through the Age of Enlightenment. We get thinkers like Spinoza and Leibniz and Descartes who emphasize logical deduction, and we get Hobbes, and now we will discuss today John Locke, who emphasize empiricism. John Locke emphasized the fact that ideas come from observation of reality. And one of the main ways he did this was through a set of withering critiques on the idea of innate ideas. You will remember that all three rationalists we discussed in the last two podcasts were big fans of innate ideas. Descartes uses the innate idea of God for him to eventually prove the existence of God. Spinoza and Leibniz use innate ideas to start off their highly systematic systems of logical deduction. They always start with one of these innate ideas. Innate means it comes in your, it is in your mind, it is born into you from some idea that's born into you from birth. And for some reason, we assume, these philosophers assume that these ideas are correct by the very nature of them being innate. As far as I can tell, there's no particular argument for why an idea is correct just because it is innate. But I think at the end of the day, there's a lot of mysticism going on here. It's the idea that, oh, well, this is just sort of the cheating, or not the cheating, but it's sort of the initial ideas that God starts you out with so that you can, you know, get started cognitively. And so they believed God, you know, wouldn't give you innate ideas that were all messed up and had nothing to do with reality. Of course, the whole idea of innate ideas ended up fading along with the idea of any knowledge whatsoever. And one of the people who legitimized this attack on knowledge was, unfortunately, the very well-intentioned John Locke. Locke was a doctor. Like Aristotle, he studied biology, and that paired very well with his preference for the real and the concrete, the here and now. You'll remember Plato was essentially, his other hobby was mathematics, whereas Aristotle, his hobby outside of, one of his many hobbies outside of philosophy was biology. And Locke was the same way, and this gave him, because biology is a much more concrete and less deductive science, this pairs quite well with his emphasis on observation, the here and now, the concrete. Locke was in fact a very good doctor, back in a day when surgery was pretty much suicide to undertake. John Locke operated on his friend, and using a silver tube, I believe he used silver because silver has antibacterial qualities, or antimicrobial, I'm not sure, but, you know, he specifically chose silver, I'm sure, and he used this tube to drain a cyst on his friend's liver, and his friend recovered. It was a successful surgery, so that's quite an achievement back in that day. As a result, he understood that there's no such thing as innate ideas. Or not as a result of the surgery, but as a result of being a more concrete-oriented kind of guy. I can assure you, Plato never, you know, dug into someone's guts and pulled out an infection. That was not his style. Locke was more of a philosopher of the here, the now, the concrete, the real. Here were some of his arguments against innate ideas. Locke used what he called the historical plane method to show that the source of any idea can be traced back from back to sensory experience. This gives us a sense of how certain of how our ideas come from actual observation and they're not innate. So, a simple example of an idea that's clearly not innate would be, where do we get the idea of animal? Well, we got this idea of combining our ideas of cats, dogs, lions, etc. Well, let's trace the history of each of these ideas. Where did we get the idea of cats, dogs? Well, we saw them. And so we've traced this abstract idea, animal, back to its original data in sense experience. We saw a bunch of objects that had locomotion. They were alive. They had consciousness, and so we call these things animals. Actually, I don't think animals have to have consciousness per se by the modern definition. But oh well, whatever. So the idea is that all your ideas can be traced back to sensory experience. Now, this is a very... Locke ended up even tracing very basic ideas that were thought to be innate. He traced them back to sensory experience. For example, one notable example is the idea of cause and effect. It was originally thought, or at least argued by some at the time, that the concept of cause and effect is innate. It is implanted in us by God, and because this idea is planted in us even when we're babies, we're able to see cause and effect relationships, and that's how we are able to recognize them. Locke says, basically, there's no reason that this knowledge couldn't have come from observation. We just notice that some things happen right after others, or that something disappears and then something reappears and then something appears at the exact moment that that other thing disappears, which over time teaches us the nature of a causal relationship. Now, this historical plane method of tracing our ideas back to sensory experience is actually a very good method. It's critical for being objective. You have to, it forces a person to actually say, well, wait, what thing in reality actually, you know, made me choose this idea? So there's a lot of ideas that people hold that don't necessarily have anything to do with reality. So, for example, let's say the concept love. A lot of people, you know, a lot of times in a philosophy class, you know, the professor will say, what is love? And then people will give their sort of their abstract idea of love. They'll tell us whatever it is they think of when they hear the word love. Oh, it's when you're willing to sacrifice yourself for someone else. And you end up getting very wildly varying answers. And there ends up, and if there's any disagreements, these disagreements have no way of being settled. Locke's historical plane method, I think, would offer a solution to these kinds of problems. It would force someone to actually say, well, wait, what things in reality actually make it necessary for us to have a concept of love. And so you could actually, it forces you to look at the facts. And this historical plane method was developed, it wasn't given a name, but it was developed even further by Ayn Rand. And I think I might be giving Locke a little bit too much credit, but he at least came up with the idea of tracing your ideas back to reality, back to sensory experience. And Rand, later, hundreds of years later, has this as basically the standard of the proof for any idea. Can you trace it back to actual sensory experience? Okay. Now, it's a test. So Locke, basically, he used the historical plane method to attack the idea of innate ideas. And it's a real testament to the freedom of the Enlightenment that Locke felt comfortable voicing these opinions, since much of the proofs of God came from arguments that were based on innate ideas. Now, by the way, Locke was still quite a believer in God. He wasn't challenging the idea of God, but he was challenging one of God's primary friends in the philosophical world, that is, this idea of innate ideas. And Locke, although he was persecuted for a number of his opinions, his life was not threatened for this one, which shows a very a relative freedom of this time period. Now let's dive further into Locke's concepts of epistemology. He believed that all knowledge comes from the senses in the form of distinct sensations that we gather. Now, these sensations he called simple ideas. They consist of hardness, coldness, blueness, any idea that cannot be broken down into simpler parts. And so, as a result, he called these simple ideas because they can't be simplified any further. Think of the idea of a black cube. Now, this is a fairly simple idea, but it is not the simplest of ideas because it can be broken into simpler ideas. We can think of the black color of the cube apart from its shape. And we can think of the cubeness, the cube, the cubic shape. We can think of it without having to think of the blackness. And so as a result of this, the color black is a simple idea. You can't break blackness into anything any further. And the cubeness, now you can break a cube into, you know, two smaller rectangular prisms, for example, or like two triangular prisms, perhaps. You can think of breaking it into that stuff. But the concept of extension, of having volumetric extension, that is a concept that is simple. Can't be broken down into anything more basic. Now, to form more complex ideas, the mind, says Locke, can manipulate these simple ideas in three major ways. There's composition. That is the uniting of ideas. This is so, for example, you can unite, or he also called this repetition. You can think of some extension, then some more extension, then some more extension. And now you have not a rectangular prism, but you have two rectangular prisms together, and you have a cube. He also thought of taking more complex idea and uniting them. So, for example, you have the idea of man, you have the idea of horse, you combine them, you got the idea of centaur. So you have that, you're able to create that idea even though a centaur is not a real thing. Another way to combine ideas is relation, thinking about two ideas simultaneously so that you can compare them. And then this is a very interesting one to point out. There is abstraction. You take a composite idea and separate part of that idea from it. So remember when I was thinking about the black cube, I thought about the blackness without having to think about the blackness coming in the form of a cube. That's abstraction. You consider one part of an idea apart from all the other parts. So, incidentally, Locke thought you become aware of these simple ideas first and foremost, that they basically come to you in the form of sensations. You see black, you feel hardness, etc. Incidentally, yeah, I don't think that's the way this works. The mind problem, what's more likely and is what's proved by some cognitive science is that the mind actually picks out entities first. So it's aware of cubes and dogs and just regular objects first, and it only becomes aware of these simple ideas that Locke talks about through a process of abstraction. First you see the black cube, then you are aware, then once you, you know, get more calm sense, then you can be capable of being aware of its blackness and say, oh yes, blackness is a quality that any object can have. And so you only become aware of the blackness once you've become aware of enough entities that are black, and then you abstract their blackness. So, this section I titled Locke Ruins Epistemology, and that probably isn't too harsh of a statement. Locke carried with him the seeds of Enlightenment's destruction. He was a champion of reason, of science, and freedom. But he carried with him epistemological principles that would make knowledge impossible, including the knowledge required to support reason, science, and freedom. He believed that pure, perfect knowledge was only possible through logical deduction from clear and distinct ideas, just like Descartes, despite his attack on innate ideas. He still believed that proof was only possible through perfect, logical, clear and distinct deduction, just as the way Descartes tried to prove it. In other words, on some level, I think what happened is that Locke pretty much accepted the premise that Descartes laid down, that in order to be absolutely certain of something, you need to eliminate any conceivable cause of doubt for that idea. And I think this approach defined the way Descartes approached his meditations and defined the way the rest of the Enlightenment approached epistemology, thus introducing arbitrary doubt into epistemology and destroying all possibility of knowledge. And we'll get even further into the ultimate expression of this in David Hume later. John Locke split knowledge into three hierarchical types. First was the intuitive. That is basically, he called it intuitive. This is clear and distinct. And so he basically thought the only clear and distinct knowledge you could have was knowledge of the self. This is an indubitable truth, Locke said. And he said it for the same reasons that Descartes, is because you cannot doubt the existence of the self, at least the self as a thinking thing. Let's see. Then there is demonstrative knowledge. This is knowledge that's like clear and distinct knowledge. You can make a rational argument for it. But it's not quite as clear and distinct because it requires a set of steps. It cannot be grasped in one cognitive motion in the way that I think, therefore I am, can be grasped indubitably. And one example of this kind of knowledge was the existence of God. He believed that God could be proven through this kind of deduction from clear and distinct ideas, just as Descartes did. But unlike Descartes, Locke put this certainty on kind of a lower hierarchical level. On the lowest level of the hierarchical totem pole would be knowledge induced from sense experience. That is knowledge that, is explained through our senses, but there's no clear and distinct connection between the different ideas that require us to accept this knowledge. And so what's hilarious about this is that Locke, being a huge champion of reason and empiricism and looking at the facts, he believed that at the end of the day, empiricism couldn't give knowledge that was quite as good as logical deduction. To make matters worse, Locke says that the mind is only aware of thoughts within itself. So the only question of whether an idea is valid or not is whether that idea has existence in addition to its other traits. He thought this exactly like Hobbes. But if the mind is unaware of its own states, but if the mind's only aware of its own states, then how do we even know whether our mental states have anything to do with the outside world? So by saying that our minds are only aware of our own mental states, then how do we even know where our senses are giving us access to the outside world? He kind of just trampled past this question, leaving us, and because he was against innate ideas, at the end of the day, anyone who follows Locke logically ends up being a total skeptic, ends up destroying all possibility of knowledge. So the reason he believed that conclusions from sense experience were doubtful is, remember, because in order to be absolutely certain of something, you have to show that it follows logically. And, you know, we see certain, whenever we form a concept, whenever we form a complex idea, according to Locke, we are attaching a bunch of simple ideas together. But although, you know, we're using our sense experience to show that, you know, furriness and wet-nosedness and, you know, paws and locomotion and consciousness, all of these things come together in the form of a dog, there's no lot, and so as a result of this, you know, we see dogs and we form the concept of dog. Even though we do this by empirical observation, there's no logical necessity for why all of these traits have to go together. So as a result, there's always a little bit of doubt. There's always a little bit of this Cartesian doubt in anything we see and conclude based on evidence of the senses. So, you know, dogs have all these properties, but why is it that they have to be that way? Why is it that they have to go together? Isn't it possible that dogs could have three legs? Sure, yeah, it's conceivable. So how do we know that we're even forming the right concept of dog? As a result of this, Locke ended up having Hobbes's same theory of concepts, the idea that concepts are just names. So Locke was a nominalist. Nom means name. The idea concepts are just names that we give to these arbitrary groupings of qualities that we see to form together. Now, from a modern perspective, we know that dogs had to exist the way they did. They had to have four legs and not three, because we understand that dogs evolved from a set of animals that have a certain bone structure, and that it would be a wild departure from their evolutionary line to suddenly have three legs instead of four. All mammals basically have a very similar bone structure, and you can see even between dogs and man that there are analogous structures. Obviously, man's hand is quite different from the paw of a dog or the wing of a bat, but if you examine it closely, each of the bone, there is a counterpart bone for each of man's bones compared to each of a dog's bones or a bat's bones. And so, you know, this knowledge wasn't known at the time, but once given enough knowledge, you see, oh wait, like, they had to be this way. They had to be this way, and so as a result, there is a sort of logical necessity for this. The problem is that if you take Locke's ideas really seriously, there's logical necessity to even doubt the theory of evolution, because you're like, okay, well, yeah, I can see this pattern, but then if you're always saying that there's room for some kind of doubt based on your experience, that your ideas are just names, then even the logical connections based on this theory are dubious, because the theory itself, which is only built from a bunch of empirical evidence, is also doubtful. So, you know, a theory of evolution won't help you avoid canine skepticism. Locke did say that there must be some necessary truths, however, that underlie the structure of things. He called this the substratum. Basically, he thought there had to be some kind of metaphysical glue that holds, you know, all these traits of dogs together and all the traits of, you know, cars together and all of the various items. But he didn't, he simply asserted that this thing existed, and gave really no reason. So in Locke, we almost see the worst of both worlds. He has Descartes' standards of proof, but Hobbes' view of concepts, leading to the seeds of total skepticism in British empiricism. He believed, like Hobbes, the causal theory of consciousness, the causal and representative theory of consciousness. The causal theory of consciousness says that our ideas are not about the world, but they are caused by the world, and they do represent the things in the world. That they're imperfect models, they're not the exact same thing as what's out there, but they're at least caused by the world, and as a result, they represent the world. But the problem with this is now your ideas are still always going to be tinged with a little bit of doubt, because it's like, okay, well, what did my mind get wrong when it represented the world in this way? And then when you think about it, if it can't represent reality perfectly, you have no idea of differentiating between, because all your ideas come from sense experience, there's no way to differentiate between the places where your mind made a mistake and the places where your mind got it right. So in the end, if you really take this theory to its logical conclusion, you end in complete skepticism. Again, we see the seeds of the total destruction of knowledge inherent in this very well-meaning philosopher, John Locke. So we also see in this the results of Cartesian thought. Descartes, by setting up clear and distinct intuition as the standard of proof, by total indubitable deduction, by which every arbitrary doubt must be banished, he has infected his progeny. Even the empiricists who rejected innate ideas, he infected all philosophy with a virus that would eventually destroy knowledge in the Western world. And in Locke we see the early stages of this cognitive disease. Now, I've made Locke look really bad, and in epistemology he was. But in his politics, his contributions were heavily influential and led to mankind's salvation from tyranny in the coming centuries. Locke wrote two treatises on government, and they were both very important, although the first one gets downplayed in its importance, and we'll see why. The first treatise is, as they call it, a period piece made to counter arguments towards the divine right of kings, as presented by Filmer. This dude Filmer at the time was arguing that he was basically like Hobbes. He was making a rationalization for why the king should have authority. Remember, this is the Enlightenment. We're in a time when freedom is starting to be seen as the norm. People are starting to wake up and say, wait a second, why are we even following these friggin' kings anyway? And so, because people were looking for logical arguments, there were a number of people lining up to, you might call them conservatives in the most literal sense of the word, people who want to keep things the way they are, want to maintain the status quo. Of course, that doesn't have any bearing on conservatives today, but they're conservative in the general sense, and these people come in with ready-made rationalizations for why kings should have authority. One of these figures was Filmer. He argued that all authority in life of one man over another is basically based on the patriarchal relationship, the relationship between father and son. Just as the father has dominion over the son, the king has dominion over all men. And as we go up the hierarchy, God has dominion over all men in total, even kings themselves. And Filmer uses all kinds of stupid scriptural arguments to back up these points. The first treatise fights against this these ideas, and it's not very well remembered because It slogs through a lot of these scriptural arguments that no one really takes seriously anymore. It attacks Filmer's scriptural arguments, which at the time were taken seriously, and so Locke had to unseat those using religious logic. But from today's standards, it's not very, we don't take it as very important. Oh, yes, we found Locke has shown that scripture doesn't give a rationalization for tyranny. But in the details of Locke, how Locke argued it, it does demonstrate how Locke was an uncompromising advocate of liberty despite his religious background. Locke argues that the relationship between father and son is not anything like the kind of relationship between king and subject. The father has dominion over the son, not because of some kind of intrinsic, you know, dominion he has over him, just because that's just the way it is. He has dominion over the son because the son has not yet attained the age of reason. The father is there to guide the son and learn and help him develop his mind, and so eventually the son will have reason and will then be free to exercise it in the choosing of his own path. Now, this was a very important connection in the doctrine of human freedom. Locke connected the concept of freedom with the use of man's rational faculty. And that, at the end of the day, is what freedom means. It is the freedom to use your mind according and act according to your mind. The Enlightenment had become free kind of by this automatic cultural process. Until Locke, there was no explicit formulation of what freedom meant. It was all kind of just implicit. As people started... As people started valuing the mind more, people started wondering, like, well, wait, if we're allowed to think, then why is it that we have this king who's telling us what to think? And so the whole idea of authority was starting to be questioned and now required some kind of philosophical basis for it to maintain any credibility. People like Filmer furnished that philosophical basis for authority. But people like Locke took the Enlightenment, the ideas implicit in the Enlightenment, that man's mind should be respected, and started to bring that attitude into a systematic philosophy, started to manifest it into a systematic philosophy. And that is Locke's primary achievement in life, is that he did this. So let's see here. A parallel I'll draw here, I think I've drawn it before, is in the show Spartacus. Spartacus is about a Roman slave who frees himself and starts freeing other people. And in order to free large numbers of slaves, Spartacus forms a slave army. And all of these, an army of freed slaves, that is. And his ideology is that of freedom. And in this show, I'm not 100% sure how it historically went. From what I understand, Spartacus was not ideological in real life, but in the show he is much more ideological, and he realizes, wait a second, I'm freeing these people off the idea that individuals should be free to choose their own path. So in the show he realizes, wait, who am I to command this army? Like, sure, I'll be their leader, but if they don't want to, if there are certain individuals who don't want to follow me, they will not be punished for doing so, because I liberated them entirely on the idea that they should be free. So why on earth? So it doesn't make any sense for them to be free from their masters, and now they got to serve me. So you can see that this philosophical idea of freedom was inherent in Spartacus's movement, at least in this show. Similarly, freedom was inherent in this new age of reason. If man is to be reasonable, he must also, by extension, be free. And man and the philosophers of the Enlightenment started to realize this bit by bit, and Locke was the one who brought it into systematic expression. And this outlining of man's freedom was the subject of his second treatise, propounding a theory of individual liberty, property, and rights. Locke based these rights off of what he called natural law. And this is a law laid down by God. It's a law of nature, just like physics, according to Locke. That it's a law that human beings should live by. And it's provided by God, just as Locke thought, you know, that physical motions, gravity and so forth, are provided by God. But just like gravity, it's discoverable in nature. Natural law, the way that man is supposed to interact with man, is discoverable in nature. Locke says that man is born free. It is his natural state to be free, and he should stay this way. If he is to be governed, he must be governed through his own consent. Now, thinkers like Filmer, you can see Filmer wasn't a fan of all this newfangled liberty that was going around during the Enlightenment. Thinkers like Filmer would say that if this was really the case, if it's really true that man has to consent to be governed, then why would any man consent to be governed? Because then what he's doing, if a man consents to be governed, he's voluntarily limiting his own freedom. He now no longer has the freedom to murder, to steal, to take advantage of other people. He's losing out on all kinds of ranges of action that he could have had without a government. So he's basically saying, by the logic of these individualists, we would be a total freaking anarchy. To sort of illustrate this point, think of the show Game of Thrones. I'm always using Game of Thrones. You have the people north of the wall who are savages, basically. They're called the Wildlings. And even though they're savages, they do have this very primitive idea of freedom. Like, oh, well, we're not like the people down south, the people who kneel to kings. But there's a real sense in which the people down south are superior because they actually have a social order. It's not just anarchy for them. They have governments and systems that protect people from random roving gangs of criminals. And so it's, you know, down south, people might have to kneel, which, you know, Locke would have been against and I'm against, but at least there's some kind of social order. And so if Locke was to come around into Westeros and say, oh, guys, you guys got to be, I propose that we're free, that we only be governed by our own consent. Everyone would look at Locke and say, you're freaking crazy. You want us to live like the Wildlings? Are you kidding? They can't even build stone structures, let alone have any kind of social order. So you can see, and this is the perspective that Filmer is coming from. He's coming from the perspective that you have two options. You have authority and civilization, or freedom and total savagery, a sort of state of nature. I guess he'd be on board with Hobbes, is that, you know, in a state of nature, it's a war of all against all. One of the most epic things ever said in philosophy, the war of all against all. Anyway, that's the way freedom was basically seen. But Locke blasts this perspective. He blows it out of the water. And he says basically, it is in a man's interest to submit, to consent to government, because with laws, he no longer has to worry about living in fear of the tyranny of his neighbor. And he works out something that is really, really important to the definition of freedom. He defines rights as being negative, as basically saying rights as being a duty that men have to other people, not to steal from one another, not to kill each other, not to take advantage of each other, and or fraud them out of their stuff. And Locke says that the purpose of government is to prevent these things. If the government does more than this, if it starts taking property, it becomes just as bad as a thief. But if the government taking the property without consent, and he was a little bit fuzzy on what consent meant, as we'll see much later during the rise of socialism in the Western world. But he basically said the government is there to protect you, and is to protect you from these violations of your freedoms, and in so doing, you actually gain freedom. You may lose the supposed freedom to hurt other people, but you gain the freedom to not be hurt yourself. And Locke basically says there is no such thing as the freedom to hurt other people, because if there were, that freedom would stand in contradiction to the other man's freedom to not be hurt. And so he redefines freedom from being this chaotic state of nature to being freedom being a very orderly system that requires a government in order to ensure. And Locke gives three major advantages that government has over the freedom inherent in a state of nature. First, it subordinates force to objective law. Now, that's kind of an objectivist formulation I'm giving, but here's the way he said it, is basically, instead of an individual person's passion for revenge, you know, he stole my goat and now I'm going to go out and kill him. It's an arbiter. It's basically, there's some kind of objective law and system of proof where it's determined, well, did he really steal your goat or did your goat run away, Mr. Goat Herder, you know? And so if the goat herder is pissed, he's less likely to see reason. He's more likely to be governed by passions and conduct his justice in a non-objective way. Locke says these laws make it cut and dry, or at least the laws aren't always going to be right, but at least we're going to see what the laws are. They're going to be conducted systematically and they're open towards change and improvement over time. And so that's what it means for them to be conducted objectively. Although I don't think he used that word. But that's basically what he meant. The government also is there as an arbiter in the case of disputes. You know, I say you stole my goat. You say that I've had this goat for a long time. We need an both sides have a conflict of interest and can't be perfectly and aren't necessarily going to be perfectly rational and objective. So we have a third party come in to settle the dispute. Now, Locke said that the basis of his theory of liberty is self-ownership. If a person owns himself, that means that he should not have a property in all of his actions, so long as those actions do not violate the ability for other people to conduct themselves the way they want. Again, very important formulation in understanding liberty. You can't construe liberty in a way that violates other people's liberty, Locke says. And his concept of self-ownership, of having a property in yourself, leads to having a property in objects outside of yourself. And this is what we call property today. That is the absolute authority over particular physical objects that are yours. And then it ends up being extended to ideas as well, and that's intellectual property. But that comes later. So there was private property in Europe at this time, although it was, of course, tenuous because of the existence of kings who could expropriate it in the form of taxes or in the form of just frickin' taking it by certain laws. But in general, there was this concept of property. And like other institutions during the Enlightenment, people started questioning it. People started saying, wait, by what right? And they thought of this fundamentally wrong, I think, but this is the way they approached it. They said, the whole concept of property clashed with the Christian view. The Christian view is God put all the bounty of the earth on the earth for all men to use in common. And so how is it that suddenly you're allowed to use that knife and I'm not allowed to use it? Because that knife, all that knife is just a bunch of melted down iron ore. God put that in the ground. You know, it was part of the common stock before you pulled it out of the ground. Like, why do you get to use, now that you turn it into a knife, why do you get to use that and I don't? So they started questioning the whole concept of private property. Some thinkers, such as Hugo Grotius, he tried to defend property by saying that basically in the beginning we had universal communism of property, that everyone just used everything in common. But then one day over the course of history, there was a universal consent towards private property. That after a while, everyone agreed that, okay, it's okay for you to keep your own property and I won't mess with it, and that's your right. He basically said, and this is okay, says Grotius, because at one point everyone agreed, there was universal consent towards the institution of property. Now, this is clearly ridiculous, and Filmer, in a very sarcastic passage, indicates how ridiculous he said. Filmer basically said, wow, that must have been amazing. Every single dude on the entire planet said, yes, we will now have private property. Imagine that. If there was even one, imagine how awesome that was. Because think about it. If even one dude said, no, I don't want property, then the whole institution of private property would be unjustified. But Grotius, man, What an amazing thing he's discovered when he found that everyone just happened to agree. So Filmer's being quite the sarcastic prick. And I think he's misinterpreting Grotius a little bit. It sounded like Grotius meant something more along the lines that, you know, one dude fenced off his property and he said, "No, this is going to be mine now." And then other people were like, "All right, like, I consent to that. I'm not going to use your property." And so this caused them to follow suit, fence off their own property, and this chain reaction continued on. So in some sense, everyone consented to the institution of private property as soon as one dude started using it. You know, I'm not sure where some of these historical... You know, this whole... I think they used a lot of historical, like, rationalism back then. This is me just going off the top of my head, so take it for what it's worth. But I noticed they use these really artificial constructs. Like, they assume that man held objects in common before there was such thing as property. That doesn't sound historically right at all. I know that men, like, had their individual stuff, but then, you know, it was taken from them by tyrants. But there's no evidence that men had, like, universal communism at any point. Although I think the American Indians did work that way. So another example of this historical rationalism, where they just assume that there was some kind of, you know, primitive state man was in that was in some kind of way, is the state of nature. They're assuming that there was some point at which men didn't have government and that that's somehow a natural state. That seems like a very... That idea seems very disconnected from reality to me. I don't think they were thinking... I think it just shows sort of the rationalism of the time is very disconnected from reality. I don't know. That's me going off on a tangent. So the problem with Grotius's argument isn't what Filmer notes, but I think the problem is that they're just approaching the issue of property all wrong. There's just, by definition, there's no such thing as communal property. There's no justification for everyone to use a tool or a piece of land to begin with, because a piece of land or a tool is only the product of a single person, never the group. So there's no justification to begin with anyway. Now someone who was probably thinking along these same lines was this German philosopher, Samuel von Pufendorf, whom Locke was a very big fan of. And he said, there's no such thing as common dominion. Common dominion is just the unclaimed resources that all men have a right to claim, but it's not theirs until they do claim it. So if there's, you know, iron ore sitting in the ground, there's a sense in which it is held in common. It's part of the common stock, but it doesn't belong to you until you pull that iron ore out of the ground. Then it's yours. Now, Locke agreed with this, and he used this kind of logic to define what property is to begin with. He believed that because a man owns himself, that he has a right to his own body and his own actions. And when a man takes some piece of earth from the common stock, say, you know, he pulls iron ore out of the ground, and he mixes it with his own labor, you know, he had to labor to pull it out of the ground, he had to labor to melt it down, he had to labor to shape it into the form of a knife, that object is now his. The form of the knife is a product of that man's labor. It's a product of that man. It's in fact, that physical object, that iron ore now in the form of a knife, is part of that man in a very real sense. Because the man owns his body, he owns his labor, he owns the product of his labor. He has a property in that knife. So he defends a man's right to accumulate as much property as he wants, as long as he's not taking things from the earth and then putting them to waste. So, like, you know, he harvests apples and then lets them rot in his silo. But he says, look, like, that doesn't happen, because what does a man do once he accumulates a bunch of these apples? He sells them, and he sells them in exchange for some kind of non-perishable good, like gold, for example, and he accumulates his property in the form of non-perishables, and he has a right to accumulate as much of that property as he wants, because He's not taking it away from anyone. He's producing it. He's pulling it from the common stock, adding his own labors to it. It's his. Now, there's an interpretation. So this concept of property, absolutely freaking essential to the founding of America. The idea that you have a right to yourself and what you produce. Absolutely essential. And this ended up forming the intellectual framework for what liberty is and what it means and why it's justified. Locke is like the Newton of individual liberty. He didn't necessarily originate all the ideas. For example, you know, Newton didn't originate Kepler's laws. Just as Locke didn't originate the idea of the common stock being something that anyone could claim, Locke didn't originate all these ideas, but he formed them all together into a comprehensive view of what liberty is, what it consists of, and most importantly, what it doesn't consist of. It doesn't consist of a savage running around doing whatever the hell he wants, like killing people. Formulates liberty in what it consists of, what it doesn't consist of, and forms a justification. Locke was the Newton of individual liberty, providing a framework that would be taken for granted for centuries to come. Unfortunately, far too few centuries, but just enough to form the United States of America. Now, on this note, I want to address something that really pissed me off. There's this interpretation that I've heard, that I've been reading from a lot of, hearing and reading from a lot of professors, that Locke was some kind of conservatives, that he was some kind of conservative, that he rejects the totalitarianism of Hobbes because he goes to extreme. He basically casts Locke as a defender of the status quo, that somehow the status quo was that of property. But that just isn't the case at all. Locke lived in a time where there were kings, for Christ's sake. Locke was a radical political thinker who believed that if he didn't believe this at first, actually. At first he thought the people didn't have the right to rebel. Then he said, okay, you have the right to rebel, but you still have to submit to whatever punishment is accorded you by law. But then he becomes radical and he says, no, if the law is wrong, if it's fundamentally against the principles of human liberty, the people have the right to overthrow that government and institute a government that does protect individual liberty. What does that remind you of, by the way? And so Locke was a radical. Locke wanted to significantly change the systems of government in further accord with individual liberty. And indeed, he was not just an armchair thinker in this struggle for liberty. He participated in it. He helped orchestrate the overthrow of King James in England, and this was known as the Glorious Revolution because very little blood was spilt. Basically, James was a Catholic, and Locke believed that Catholicism was a threat to individual liberty, and so he wanted him out. And eventually, through Locke's efforts and the efforts of many, Locke didn't play a huge role, nothing like the role, say, like, you know, Thomas Jefferson or George Washington performed in the American Revolution, but he helped out with this glorious revolution. And more importantly, Locke's ideas, as we keep saying, form the foundation of the American experiment in liberty years later, and provided its justification. According to the Declaration of Independence, men are endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. And we can see how these very ideas come directly from Locke. The purpose of government is to secure rights. Man has specific rights, and the purpose of government is to secure them. And when a government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and institute new government that does perform the function it is intended for. Locke put into a systematic political philosophy the reasons for why man should be free, and what in particular freedom consists of, and what it does not consist of, inspiring the creation of what is perhaps the Age of Reason's most important achievement, the United States of America.